welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never that debt is fraud, and we have to start understanding why compliance of the Constitution is important, which is why we go through this content. Now, we just kind of covered how right out the gate, Hamilton, you know, with his machinations in trying to undermine our Constitution, literally started speaking 180 out as a Secretary of the Treasury under this new Constitution, where he actually said this was a limited and defined government, you know, the powers delegated. I mean, he was completely on board with how this Constitution was defined. Then all of a sudden, now that we got it, well, actually, we got these implied powers, and we can do all. He literally started speaking out the other side of his mouth, which really lays out, folks, the question is, why is it that, because the empirical data proves in this next article that I'm writing, and, you know, doing regarding the Federalist Papers and Hamilton's last eight articles, helps expose this pernicious individual who deliberately created these little hooks for the courts, and he literally created this evil paradigm that as long as the majority of Congress agreed, they can do anything they want. That right there is antithetical to how the Constitution was ratified. Now, we're going to get into today, because we just wrapped up the Funding Act yesterday with Sean and I. Now, today, welcome back, Tammy. Welcome back, Sean, because what we're going to be doing today is we're going to cover the debates in Congress over the Banking Act that Hamilton was proposing. I believe anybody look at the date on this. What I think it's 1791. The debates went from kind of March 4th, 1789, to March 3rd, 1791. It wasn't until the Assumption Act itself, where Hamilton actually laid out that, oh, because of the Assumption Act, we have to create this bank. And that is what infuriated Jefferson and Madison, because Madison and Jefferson were saying, hey, you know, we don't like this Assumption Act, but, you know, it's a violation, and if it needs to keep the Union, then okay, and we'll make these concessions. So they went to bed with the devil. And then they realized that the devil was bringing into bed with them a lot of things that they just weren't even expecting, which this bank was one of those things. So this is when Madison, and actually I believe they were on a trip to Massachusetts, the two of them, when, you know, they were discussing this, you know, the problem of this national bank and what this little creature, Hamilton, was doing. And that was the genesis of the Republican Party being established by Madison in 1792. Thomas Jefferson was really, you know, on board, and it was both of them, but I think Madison was the one that actually formalized it based on the two of them agreeing that they needed to create a resistant party. That party sat there and languished because, for the most part, they either had their hands full dealing with Hamilton constantly trying to drag the nation sideways, or there were other issues or other matters that they just never they never had the impetus. They never had that catalyst that said, okay, it's time to unite, all hands on deck. Folks, I'm telling you today, all hands on deck. We need all hands on deck. With the way things are going, you may think this is good. As we talked about in previous shows, I'm going to tell you right now that when we're allowing the good guy to, you know, have access to bypassing the Constitution, It's going to still be available for the bad guy when they come in. We cannot allow these types of things to continue. You better start standing up, folks, because you will rue the day for not actually having the test of fortitude to taking the stand now. You're going to rue the day that you didn't do this. And that day is coming soon, very soon, because everything that's being set up, it could even happen underneath Trump's watch. While everybody thinks that this is our guy, the worst things that can happen could happen very soon. And who's not seeing this? I mean, the heavens are telling us things are changing. But putting all that aside, what I wanted to do, because it is Thanksgiving time, and we were just talking about, prior to the show, about Thanksgiving, I want to make an appeal, folks, because every year I do this, and I do this on the day of Thanksgiving, or the day before Thanksgiving, and the day after. The Friday show, I usually have a new show, but the reason I do it on the day before is I try to remind you, please don't feast and have a day of gluttony on Thanksgiving. Don't complain about the morals of our society and do nothing, because that makes you a hypocrite. And you know what? Your kids are smart. Your kids recognize your hypocrisy. So why don't you put your money in your mouth why don't you put your money where your mouth is and get your mouth to actually do what you should be doing? Now, I understand, because it was already expressed that, oh, shoot, GR, the family's coming together. We want to have this feast. Folks, we're going to read the proclamation. I would ask that you read it, go through it now. We're going to do this on Wednesday and Thursday, but I ask that you go and read George Washington's Proclamation of Thanksgiving. He's calling upon the nation to serve him, our Creator, to sanctify this Constitution for the blessing he gave us by giving us that Constitution. How else can you sanctify the blessings that he's given us other than by service and sacrifice? So Thursday should be a day of fast. Thursday should be a day going out and helping those who need help, helping, the widow who's got, a mess in her yard, helping those people who really need help. I'll let you choose to what that is, but that's how we actually can start sanctifying this nation, by actually setting aside. And so, folks, what's going to keep you on Thursday morning to get together as the family that is assembled and say, thank you, Lord, for giving us this Constitution? We set aside this day, our services and, our sacrifice to you, and forego having breakfast and lunch and then coming back and having a light dinner and wrapping up the day and being so thankful for this nation. And then on Friday, have your feast. To heck with the Black Friday sales. To heck with all these other things. If you want to save America, don't tell me I'm not giving you what you need to do. If nobody else is going to say it, then okay, I got to say it. We've got to start recognizing and changing our behavior, or we're just as insane as everybody else, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. So welcome back, Tammy. Welcome back, Sean. Are you guys ready to get into the debate over the national bank?
Yes, sir.
All right. So this is kind of this document is not a quasi, or it's not an official, document formulated by Congress or anything like that. This is a document that was kind of formulated outside of the record, not outside, because they actually cut and pasted out of the records to create this document. I think you do find this on the Library of Congress. If you actually look for the debate over the national bank, you'll find all of this type of stuff, all this data in this one little document. But what they do in this 9-page document is they actually bring forward the arguments that were made by the different individuals. In this document, it possesses the argument of James Madison, Fisher Ames, Secretary Thomas Jefferson, and Secretary Alexander Hamilton. And so we want to go through this. And one of the things that I'm going to be jumping up and down on is how Madison lays out the metric. In understanding government, there is a metric. There is a standard. And we have to always keep in mind and apply that standard so that we don't deviate. And that standard is how the Constitution was described as explained to the states at the time of ratification. When the Federalists basically said, this is what this line means, that became gospel. That became hard written fact. That's what that line meant. Now, the jurists today are just basically making it up as they go along. They're redefining everything. We can't allow this to continue. This is why we're in this mess. Under the fundamental tenets of contract law, and Madison clarified this throughout the resolutions and explaining them, that as things were stipulated in the ratification debates, those stipulations became literal terms and definitions and stipulations and standards of the compact. And I hope you appreciate this. I hope you understand how these things are literally. So when you go through contract negotiations and somebody actually redefines and clarifies a term or a clause in the contract, that instantly becomes a legal appendage to that contract. In other words, you don't have to go through the Article 5 process to amend the Constitution when you are in the negotiation stage. Everybody needs to write notes, and if it is being actually orally stated and you're writing those things down, then you have it in writing how the Constitution was stipulated. This is why Madison emphasizes the ratification debates as the only metric, the only standard that you can apply to the Constitution in understanding what it means. If, by chance, there is something in the Constitution that was not discussed in the ratification debates, then the next step in the metric would be going to Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. Why? Because that's how the delegates pounded out the reasoning of why they did what they did in creating that Constitution. That is the most accurate clarity as to other than the ratification debates. Everything else, opinions, Federalist Papers, editorials, they're nice, they're insightful, but they have no legal standing. The two documents that have legal standing, again, are the ratification debates and the notes on the convention. So with that, I think, Tammy, are you ready to dig into James Madison's speech of February 2nd, 1791?
How far do you want me to go?
So actually, let's have you go until the heater kicks off.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Is the power of establishing an incorporated bank among the powers vested by the Constitution and the legislature of the United States? This is the question to be examined. After some general remarks on the limitations of all political power, he took notice of the peculiar manner in which the federal government is limited. It is not a general grant out of which particular powers are accepted. It is a grant of particular powers only, leaving the general mass in other hands. So it had been understood by its friends and its foes, and so it was to be interpreted. As preliminaries to a right interpretation, he laid down the following rules. An interpretation that destroys the very characteristic of the government cannot be just. Where a meaning is clear, the consequences, whatever they may be, are to be admitted. Where doubtful, it is fairly triable by consequences. In controverted cases, the meaning of the parties to the instrument, if to be collected by reasonable evidence, is a proper guide. Contemporary and concurrent expositions are a reasonable evidence of the meaning of the parties.
Okay, and so what he was talking about, so let me interrupt you right there.
Okay.
That line right there, contemporary and concurrent expositions are a reasonable evidence of the meaning of the parties. And so that right there was laying out the ratification base, because those expositions, those debates, is what he was talking about. He gets into this more, but this is the first hint he lays out that says, hey, we cannot not use those debates as they were describing this, or as he used expositions as the reasonable evidence of the meaning of the party. So go ahead.
In admitting or rejecting a constructive authority, not only the degree of its incidentality to an express authority is to be regarded, but the degree of its importance also, since on this will depend the probability or improbability of its being left to construction. Reviewing the Constitution with an eye to these positions, it was not possible to discover in it the power to incorporate a bank. The only clauses under which such a power could be pretended are either the power to lay and collect taxes to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare, or the power to borrow money on the credit of the United States, or the power to pass all laws necessary and proper to carry into execution those powers. The third clause is that which gives the power to pass all laws necessary and proper to execute the specific powers.
Okay, so
whatever meaning this.
Go ahead. I'm going to dive in on this too, because clearly he's basically saying that there have been two powers that have been granted: the power to collect taxes and debts. In other words, they have the ability to collect taxes. That's a power granted. The power to borrow money on the credit of the United States is another power granted. So for them to come along and create a power, or I should say, laws necessary and proper for the execution of those powers, those laws must be direct derivatives of the power. Now, this is language that they didn't have back then, but it had to derive from the power. It couldn't be implied with the power. In other words, well, I mean, if it's got something to do with money, banks have something to do with money. That's implied. But if it's not derivative, in other words, this ability to collect taxes, is that derived? Is a bank derived from collecting taxes? No. A collection agency, you know, the marshals of going and collecting taxes, the treasury to receive those taxes. But a bank is something completely different, and it functions completely outside of the necessity or the laws necessary in collecting taxes. It's the same thing when we look at the creating credit, being able to take debt from another nation, that is a derived, so in other words, creating a contract that we owe you money and thank you for giving us this money. Is the bank derived out of that power as an object that is a part of the power? In other words, to be able to receive that money and create byproducts of bonds and so forth. That's what would be needed within the Constitution to justify a bank within those powers. If not, then those powers are the laws being created that are using implication is not derivative. It is literally just providing laws that are out of scope. The Constitution wasn't a guide to give the federal government the discretion to decide what to do. It limited them to these very specific objects. You could take on debt. You can pay that debt. You can collect taxes to pay that debt. Nowhere was there a derivative or an object such as a bank, which provided all these other different functions. So clearly, when we go through the ratification debates, which we've just recently did, Tam and I, this past summer, the word bank only showed up twice in all of the ratification debates, and it had no context to the receiving of money, the taxation, or anything. The references to the banks were pointing to international banks of a foreign nation. I think Holland was one, and I forget what the other one was. But go ahead and continue with the next paragraph. Thank you so much.
Whatever meaning this clause may have, none can be admitted that would give an unlimited discretion to Congress. Its meaning must, according to the natural and obvious force of the terms and the context, be limited to means necessary to the end and incident to the nature of the specified powers. Clause is, in fact, merely declaratory of what would have resulted by unavoidable implication as the appropriate and, as it were, technical means of executing those powers. And this since it had been explained by the friends of the Constitution and ratified by the state conventions.
Okay, so there's that word. In this sense, it has been explained by the friends of the Constitution and ratified by the states. In other words, as the Federalists explained it, the states accepted it, and they moved forward accepting these hard limitations. He's pointing this out because this is what's important. Who are the sovereigns over this Constitution? It's not the Supreme Court. It's not the President. It's not even Congress. They're the creatures of the compact. These entities are created by the compact. So who is it that is sovereign over the compact? It is the states.
The states.
There we go. Okay, so Madison's schooling us here. This is not the first time Madison schooled Congress regarding the importance of these ratification debates. Go ahead. Keep going.
The essential characteristic of the government as composed of limited and enumerated powers would be destroyed if instead of direct and incidental means, any means could be used, which in the language of the preamble to the bill might be conceived to be conducive to the successful conducting of the finances, or might be conceived to tend to give facility to the obtaining of loans. He urged an attention to the diffuse and ductile terms which had been found requisite to cover the stretch of power contained in the bill. He compared them with the terms necessary and proper used in the Constitution and asked whether it was possible to view the two descriptions as synonymous or the one as a fair and safe commentary. The latitude of interpretation required by the bill is condemned by the rule furnished by the Constitution itself. It is not pretended that every insertion or omission in the Constitution is the effect of systematic attention. This is not the character of any human work, particularly the work of a body of men. The examples cited, with others that might be added, sufficiently inculcate, nevertheless, a rule of interpretation very different from that on which the bill rests. They condemn the exercise of any power, particularly a great and important power which is not evidently and necessarily involved in an express power.
Okay, so as he continues on, he's really kind of laying this argument down that this was clearly defined as very limited. They couldn't just make things up. We have to make sure that we're being held. We, Congress, are being held to how the states understood this document. As representatives of the people of these states, we owe them the due diligence to ensure that we hold those truths, those definitions that were provided, that we stay in fidelity to those definitions, that we maintain that fidelity, that the virtue of this nation depends on this. I would have loved to have seen some language like that, because that kind of imbues what Madison is saying. But Madison is not one to kind of, is the preachy kind of guy. I guess I may be a little more preachy. And I don't think Jefferson was a preachy guy. He was really more of a hardcore, brutal man when it came down to using his use of the vernacular. But I think the point here is, as we're moving down this, we're pretty much out of time. I didn't want to, go into the next one. So when we come back, we're going to kind of click through the rest of this, and we'll actually have Sean pick this up. But thank you, Tammy, for picking this up. And when we get into this, you're going to actually find how Madison actually not only just points to the ratification debates, but he actually uses them and reads them. And so this is not the first time. This is a consistency. That's what's really important here, folks, is Madison has been consistent in the cod fishery bounties. We already read this to you before we got into the Constitution. We read to you how Madison pointed to the ratification debates. He's doing it again here. How many times in the different debates, we're only covering very specific topics. How many times when it comes down to them pushing the limits, did Madison remind them of the ratification basin? We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so getting back into this now, as we kind of lay this out, I think this is very impressive because this is one of the records that actually identified the fact of which ratification debates Madison actually reads from. So, Sean, now I'm not sure if you're muted or not, but we're coming back here. If you could pick up from, I believe it's the top of the page, right? And go ahead and let's start diving into Madison's continued assertions of how we're, as Congress, how they're supposed to be behaving in representing the good people of their state.
It cannot be denied that the power proposed to be exercised is an important power. As a charter of incorporation, the bill creates an artificial person previously not existing in law. It confers important civil rights and attributes which could not otherwise be claimed. It is, though not precisely similar, at least equivalent to the naturalization of an alien, by which certain new civil characters are acquired by him. Would Congress have had the power to naturalize if it had not been expressly given? He proceeded next to the contemporary expositions given to the Constitution. The defense against the charge founded on the want of a Bill of Rights presupposed, he said, that the powers not given were retained, and that those given were not to be extended by remote implications. On any other supposition, the power of Congress to abridge the freedom of the press or the rights of conscience, etc., could not have been disproved. The explanations in the state conventions all turned on the same fundamental principle, and on the principle that the terms necessary and proper gave no additional powers to those enumerated. Here he read sundry passages from the debates of the Pennsylvania, Virginia, and North Carolina conventions, showing the grounds on which the Constitution had been vindicated by its principal advocates against a dangerous latitude of its powers charged on it by its opponents.
Okay, so he uses the word here, vindicated, and what that means is the victory of the true definitions that were being provided by the Federalists were what the delegates of each state accepted. In other words, as they were battling back and forth from the liars and the deceivers of the Anti-Federalists to what the Federalists were literally saying, and we go through this painstakingly every time we go through the ratification debates. When you look at what is being said by the Anti-Federalists, what they're saying is that this clause is a problem and that they're going to do these things when the things that they identify they're doing are direct violations of those clauses. In other words, it's not like the Constitution is giving them the authority for them to do those things. They would be violating the actual Constitution. And so the Federalists had to keep pointing this out, that, hey, the Constitution doesn't allow that. The Constitution only allows this. Ergo, what you're talking about would be literally a violation against the Constitution. There were points in time where Madison actually got George Mason to back up and say, yeah, you're right. But there's this, you know, this propensity of, you know, these, you know, the meandering of politics, they're going to go down these paths. Well, this was also basically addressed in different ratification debates where it was said, yes, of course, it is always the nature of man to actually go outside the bounds of their limitations. But that doesn't mean that the Constitution is the problem. That means that we are the problem. Men are the problem. Don't blame the Constitution that, you know, people are going to assume power is not granted. It's not the Constitution's fault. This is why, you know, and they covered this, that the states would need to be vigilant in watching over their compact. Folks, this is the importance of constitutional compliance. Because our states, because we've trusted these very, I'll just say these individuals who have ingratiated themselves over the course of hundreds of years, 250 years of people allowing the federal government and their own state governments to actually defy the rule of law, defy the Constitution, and do things without the proper authority at all. What is it going to take to get you to stand up? As we go through this, my head spins. Anyway, as we move through this, he's reading Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Virginia debates. There's no doubt in my mind, the people that are sitting there as Madison is helping them understand how this was actually defined, as far as I'm concerned, he ended the argument right here. Anybody that would have chosen to go otherwise would have really stood in jeopardy. But let me just point out one problem, that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment didn't exist. I believe had it did exist, Madison would have thrown that on the table to say, anybody that votes for this, we're going to go back to your state and say, you get rid of these guys. As a matter of fact, technically, if he couldn't get that level of support, that's what he'd have to do. But technically, he should have garnered that kind of support out of Congress, because anybody that actually would not vote to remove these people for violating their oath would stand in jeopardy as well. I mean, this is how we could really start clearing. This is why I point to this all the time. You want to clear up government? You want to get government doing what it's supposed to do? The day you hold them accountable is the day they behave. You got kids? You ever held your kids accountable? The day you hold them accountable is the day they behave. It's that simple. Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry. Keep going.
He did not undertake to vouch for the accuracy or authenticity of the publications which he quoted. He thought it probable that the sentiments delivered might in many instances have been mistaken or imperfectly noted. But the complexion of the whole, with what he himself and many others must recollect, fully justified the use he had made of them.
Okay, right there. What he just said was, there may have been words that may not have been accurate. There may have been things, the way they were expressed, that weren't necessarily, you know, word for word. But what he was basically saying is the fact that you had three debates and the tone of all of them were basically alluding to the exact same point, that the powers granted are clear and defined. Anything that's not granted, they can't do. In other words, he was pointing not to the complexity, but the simplicity, in my word, of the harmony between the message that was being given by each of the Federalists in the different states. They weren't arguing differently. They were just using different words. And they were saying the same thing. These powers are limited and defined. Keep going.
The explanatory amendments proposed by Congress themselves, at least, would be good authority with them. All these renunciations of power proceeded on a rule of construction, excluding the latitude now contended for. These explanations were the more to be respected as they had not only been proposed by Congress, but ratified by nearly three-fourths of the states. He read several of the articles proposed, remarking particularly on the 11th and 12th, the 9th and 10th Amendments, the former as guarding against a latitude of interpretation, the latter as excluding every source of power not within the Constitution itself. With all this evidence of the sense in which the Constitution was understood and adopted, will it not be said, if the bill should pass, that its adoption was brought about by one set of arguments and that it is now administered under the influence of another set? And this reproach will have the keener sting because it is applicable to so many individuals concerned in both the adoption and the administration. In fine, if the power were in the Constitution, the immediate exercise of it cannot be essential. If not there, the exercise of it involves the guilt of usurpation and establishes a precedent of interpretation, leveling all the barriers which limit the powers of the general government and protect those of the state's government. If the point be doubtful only, respect for ourselves, who ought to shun the appearance of precipitancy and ambition, respect for our successors, who ought not lightly to be deprived of the opportunity of exercising the rights of legislation. Respect for our constituents, who have had no opportunity of making known their sentiments, and who are themselves to be bound down to the measure for so long a period. All these considerations require that the irrevocable decision should at least be suspended until another session.
Okay, so he was like throwing out this, okay, if anything, let's just wait till we get another session, because maybe the voters will actually bring people in that are going to unseat you people that want to do these things that you don't have the authority to do. Well, now, let me ask you both. Do you think that they would want to actually delay their vote in deciding this to allow the election to affect it? Either of you?
No way.
I mean, Tammy, do you see the... You know, it's like, why would we deny ourselves the payout on this corruption, right?
Mm-hmm.
All righty. So Madison's not done. He's got one more paragraph, and then we dive into Fisher Ames. So go ahead. Finish that up, Sean.
Okay. Where was I?
It appeared on the whole. The last paragraph there.
Okay. In fine, if the power in the Constitution... The immediate exercise of it cannot be essential. If not there, the exercise of it involves the guilt of usurpation and establishes a precedent of interpretation, leveling all the barriers which limit the powers of the general government and protect those of the state governments. If the point be doubtful only, respect for ourselves, I think I read this, who ought to shun the appearance of precipitancy and ambition, respect for our successors, who ought not lightly be deprived of the opportunity of exercising the rights of legislation. Respect for our constituents, who have had no opportunity of making known their sentiments, and who are themselves to be bound down to the measure for so long a period. All these considerations require that their irrevocable decision should at least be suspended until another session. It appeared on the whole, he concluded, that the power exercised by the bill was condemned by the silence of the Constitution, was condemned by the rule of interpretation arising out of the Constitution, was condemned by its tendency to destroy the main characteristic of the Constitution, was condemned by the exposition of the friends of the Constitution, whilst depending before the public, was condemned before by the apparent intention of the parties which ratified the Constitution, was condemned by the explanatory amendments proposed by Congress themselves to the Constitution, and he hoped it would receive its final condemnation by the vote of this House.
Yeah, you did. So you did read that one.
Yeah,
as a matter of fact,
twice.
It's always a good clue when you read something like precipitancy.
Right.
What's the chance of that word showing up again? Okay, so he lays out, and actually I'm going to do this just because it is that important. So he starts this paragraph off and says, it appeared on the whole, he concluded, that. And now he starts off this list. And so the very first item that he's identifying is the power exercise, right? So what we have here, I'm going to basically create this paragraph. So or a listing of first argument, second argument, third argument. So the first argument is the power exercised by the bill was condemned by the silence of the in other words, it's not within the Constitution. Two, was condemned by the rule of interpretation arising out of the Constitution. In other words, you can't just interpret something. It's got to be there. Was condemned by its tendency to destroy the main characteristics of the Constitution. The fourth one was condemned by the expositions, or those things that were explained by the Federalist of the Constitution while depending before the public. In other words, while it was waiting to be ratified by the delegates in the convention. Was condemned by the apparent intention of the parties which ratified the Constitution. And six, was condemned by the explanatory amendments proposed by Congress themselves to the Constitution. And seven, finally, and he hoped it would receive its final condemnation by the vote of this House. So there you go. When you look at something within the Constitution, Madison lays out that there's this layer of things that say, it didn't get past this first barrier. It didn't get past the fact that it is not within the Constitution. He uses the term silence of the Constitution. I would replace that with not within the Constitution. It didn't get past this thing that it doesn't arise outside of the Constitution or out of the Constitution. It's only by interpretation of its arising. My bad. So the rule of interpretation was condemned by the tendency to destroy the main characteristic. In other words, this whole concept of implied powers actually gets completely away from defined powers. And so as you go through this list of seven, when you have a petition, here's a good hint. These are the things that you can use to help fortify why, the failure to repel invaders, is being violated, or these are the points that, just don't muster up, why we're not repelling invaders. Does that make sense to both of you? Highlighting these seven arguments really help when we start looking at the Constitution with that level of scrutiny. Like Madison, he's basically giving us how we can actually help sell this concept that, it didn't make through any of these barriers, not one. Anyway, so now Fisher Ames of Massachusetts is speaking on behalf of, so in other words, Fisher Ames is arguing for interpretation. Fisher Ames is basically saying we need to do whatever's necessary and proper. In other words, Fisher Ames is trying to convince Congress to take latitude, redefine the Constitution, and do what they think is best. In other words, compromising the Constitution so that they can do what they want to do. So, Tammy, go ahead and start this off with Mr. Ames.
I have a little point
go ahead.
First.
Sure, go ahead.
It's very obvious. I haven't read this before, but it's very obvious, especially with the politics that's going on today. In the first couple of statements of each one of them's speech, you can see exactly what their agenda is.
Yes. Yes.
He says, little doubt remains with respect to the utility of banks. It's like, oh, well, we need this.
Right. Okay. Go ahead, Tammy. Yeah. Go ahead. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Ames, little doubt remains with respect to the utility of banks. This, however, is not a question of expediency, but of duty. We are not at liberty to examine which of several modes of acting is entitled to the preference. But we are solemnly warned against acting at all. We are told that the Constitution will not authorize Congress to incorporate the subscribers to the bank. Let us examine the Constitution, and if that forbids our proceeding, we must reject the bill, though we shall do it with deep regret that such an opportunity to serve our country must be suffered to escape for the want of constitutional power to improve it.
Okay, so hold on here. What he's looking for, and here's the key, have you ever heard somebody say that to hold a state from seceding, the Constitution has to allow it? In other words, if a state is not happy and they want to nullify because the federal government is acting outside its bounds, there are people that say that the state cannot secede from the Union. In other words, they can't leave the Union because the Constitution has been breached and the government that they're dealing with is not the government that they signed up for. Therefore, it has to be explicit in the Constitution for the states to be able to do that. That's absolutely wrong. And as a matter of fact, this argument that he threw out here, Mr. Ames, says, and if it forbids our proceeding, we must reject the bill. So in other words, he's going down the path that we have to have this Bill of Rights of rejecting. The Constitution was never basically sold on this concept that we have to have this long list of the things we can't do. The Constitution was ratified on the principle that the government can only do those things delegated. He's throwing in there, does it forbid it? Because it doesn't forbid it, we can do it, which is contra to the whole selling of the Constitution. They can only do those things delegated. As a matter of fact, this is where, and it's nice to be able to, you know, pull up these references because, you know, sometimes, you know, we have these types of things. And so what I want to do is pull up, who is it? It was George Nicholas, help me out here. George Nicholas, in talking about whether the government can do something or not. This is in reference to the Bill of Rights. This is the Virginia ratification debates. This is what he says. In England, in all disputes between the king and the people, recurrence is had to the enumerated rights of the people to determine, are the rights in dispute secured? In other words, does the Bill of Rights protect them from what the king's going to do? Are they included in the Magna Carta Bill of Rights, etc.? If not, they are, generally speaking, within the king's prerogative. So in other words, Ames is basically saying that is there a forbidden, you know, is this a part of something that's forbidden for the government to do? Because that's what the Bill of Rights and Magna Carta was, a list of the forbidden. You can't do these things. The Constitution itself delegated very specific powers. And this is why, Nicholas, and this is why this is so important. What he says here is, in disputes between Congress and the people, the reverse of the proposition holds. Is the disputed right enumerated? If not, Congress cannot meddle with it. In other words, is this power enumerated? It doesn't have to be denied. It doesn't have to be forbidden. It has to be enumerated for them to perform. Does that make sense? Yes. Okay. So great. I believe that, you know, when we actually go through how it was actually sold, then we actually can start realizing how Ames was literally talking in contradiction to how the Constitution was being sold during the state ratification debates. Okay, so go ahead and read the next one.
Okay, while the exercise of even the lawful powers of government is disputed, and a jealous eye is fixed on its proceedings, not a whisper has been heard against its authority to establish a bank. Still, however, unseasonably, the old alarm of public discontent is sounded in our ears. Two questions occur. May Congress exercise any powers which are not expressly given in the Constitution, but may be deduced by a reasonable construction of that instrument? And secondly, will such a construction warrant the establishment of the bank?
Okay, so I'm going to dive into this, because the real question, because they're asking the representatives of the state and the representatives of the people, can they do these things? Because they're pushing the boundaries. Technically, the only person or the only group that can answer the question isn't these people that have this delegated power to represent them on the powers granted. The question is, can they actually go beyond this Constitution by going back to the states and saying, okay, you're going to let us do these things, right? Because the only authority that can make that decision, these guys don't have the authority. They took the oath to actually support the Constitution in its limited, defined terms. Therefore, they're trying to take upon themselves the authority of the states, the sovereignty of the states and the people to say, we're going to allow ourselves to go outside the boundaries of the Constitution instead of actually going to the states to say, can we do this? That's huge. That is really huge. Because now you're talking a bunch, you know, you're talking in a room of thieves and you're creating an honor of thieves. Because surely we can allow ourselves to do these things. Why not? Who's going to stop us?
Hey, the doctrine that powers may be implied, which are not expressly vested in Congress, has long been a bugbear to a great many worthy persons. They apprehend that Congress, by putting constructions upon the Constitution, will govern by its own arbitrary discretion, and therefore that it ought to be bound to exercise the powers expressly given and those only.
Yes. Keep going.
If Congress may not make laws conformably to the powers plainly implied, though not expressed in the frame of government, it is rather late in the day to adopt it as a principle of conduct. A great part of our 2 years' labor is lost, and worse than lost to the republic or to the public, for we have scarcely made a law in which we have not exercised our discretion with regard to the true intent of the Constitution. Any words but those used in that instrument will be liable to a different interpretation.
Keep going.
The danger of implied power does not arise from its assuming a new principle. We have not only practiced it often, but we can scarcely proceed without it. Nor does the danger proceed so much from the extent of the power as from its uncertainty. While the opposers of the bank exclaim against the exercise of this power by Congress, do they mark out the limits of the power which they will leave to us with more certainty than it's done by the advocates of the bank? Their rule of interpretation by contemporaneous testimony, the debates of the conventions, and the doctrine of substantive and auxiliary powers will be found as obscure and, of course, as formidable as that which they condemn. They only set up one construction against another. If, therefore, some interpretation of the Constitution must be indulged, by what rules is it to be governed? The great end of every association of persons or states is to affect the end of its institution.
Keep going.
Congress may do what is necessary to the end for which the Constitution was adopted, provided it is not repugnant to the natural rights of man or to those which they have expressly reserved to themselves or to the powers which are assigned to the states. This rule of interpretation seems to be a safe and not a very uncertain one, independently of the Constitution itself. By that instrument, certain powers are specifically delegated together with all powers necessary and proper to carry them into execution. That construction may be maintained to be a safe one which promotes the good of the society and the ends for which the government was adopted without impairing the rights of any man or the powers of any state.
Okay, so that wraps us up to that point. And so it's really obvious that there are really no boundaries that can contain Congress from doing whatever they want as long as they, at the end of the day, can justify it. It doesn't even have to come close to the enumerated objects if they feel it is necessary. This idea later on gets embraced by none other than John Marshall, the Chief Justice, and starts basically pontificating that these powers exist as long as they believe they can do these things. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.